Session number 7363.
Mr. Jameson, tape 5. Mr. Jameson, if I could just go back to your first Christmas, 1914.
Yeah.
You've explained that you had the Queen Mary gift box
yeah.
and something of your Christmas
yeah.
day. But did you witness anything about this so-called Christmas truce between the Germans and the British?
Not personally, for this reason. We'd been in the trenches. It was hard, frosty weather, very cold, and I think I told you about the rum jar on the fire step and Teddy Joycey joining me. Well, we were withdrawn, and hopefully, you see, we were withdrawn to rest just before Christmas. And we went out into rest billets while the South Staffs or somebody like that. Yes, miss. it was probably the South Staffordshire or one of the regiments took over. It would be a regiment from in our particular case, be a regiment from the 21st Brigade in the 7th Division. Well, we were withdrawn and they went into the line. And then Keith and Philip Ridley, who were two of my section, came dashing into the billet during the morning and said, "What do you know? The Jerrys are out on the top. They're walking about. They're dishing out drinks and cigarettes. There's no fighting going on." Well, we'd noticed the place was very quiet, you see. I said, "I don't believe it. In fact, this fellow's just come down. He's been part of a ration party. He went up and he just couldn't believe it." The net result of that was, I said, "Well, I can't go. I'm duty bloke for the morning on this, but hop off and see what you can find." So Keith and Philip and Leslie Wood went off, and they arrived back round about lunchtime. Keith with one of the Landwehr hats on, you see, all that grey thing with the red band round the button. Philip had a water bottle. They'd had drinks, they'd had smokes, and they'd been walking about. He said, "Just wouldn't believe it. They're walking about on the top, chatting and exchanging drinks and whatnot." And some of the Northumberland Hussars who were occupying an adjoining section of the front line, they were in another squadron. And actually, they are photographed on that reprint that appeared in the Telegraph, which I left at the IWM.
And what was the location? Where were you then?
Well, it would be somewhere in the Levante area, that frontage, the Neuve Chapelle Aubers part of the line, and we were back from there, withdrawn. There was no doubt about it. They were absolutely astounded at what he said. "They've got a football out there. They're kicking it around. They're having a marvellous time." Well, of course, as soon as the powers that be, both on our side and the Germans, were fit to throw up, you know, about all this. And the next day, of course, that Landwehr regiment were withdrawn from there, and the Prussians came into there, and they were shouting about, "Don't come any tricks today, Tommy, or you'll cop it," you see, and the fighting really did start again. Well, we occupied the front line there as relief going on, doing the usual sort of strengthening the wire at night, crawling out on listening patrols, and doing all the usual jobs you do when there's no actual fight going on, improving the trenches and everything, and then with being withdrawn and other people, the other feet going in. But once any show started, then the trained infantry soldiers took over the front line, and we became communications. We were conveying between front line and support, or in fact dog's body. Yeah.
Going back to this Christmas truce, before I go on to the rest of your experiences, did that ever happen at any other time at Christmas during the war?
No, never.
Could it have happened?
No.
Why not?
No. Well, for several reasons. One reason was that we didn't quite like the way the Germans were fighting. You see, they had quite a lot of English, and they were using that to trick people. In fact, in that book I've just read there of Lynn MacDonald's, on one occasion there, these people were moving up through a trench which was doubtful after a show, and challenged a party in the dark. It was dead night, and they challenged this party in the dark, and got no reply, and they said, "Come clean or we're going to chuck a few bombs amongst you." See, then immediately these people said, "Oh, we are so-and-so regiment." And then one fellow behind said, "They can't be that regiment. Those people have been attached to a field company away in the rear. They're not there at all." Then the fight started. You see, but that's the sort of thing they used to do. And then another thing that happened in that same book, they used to carry their machine guns on stretchers with a blanket over. You might have taken that for an ambulance thing, you see, but it wasn't. They just dropped that down, put the gun down, started shooting. I suppose we were rather, at that time of the war, we had rather more gentlemanly ideas of the way a war ought to be constructed, instead of just a cutthroat business and no quarter given anywhere, you know, which should have been the common sense way to go at it. After all, this was a war, we were out to stop it, and by any means. And that's why it never happened again. The dander was up amongst the British. You see, they weren't putting up with any more of it.
And those were things you witnessed yourself, were they? That you mentioned Lynn MacDonald's book, but you also saw evidence of that yourself.
I saw I didn't actually see machine guns being carried on stretchers, but I saw evidences of course, as I told you, we went up to get these guns out at Loos. They were very securely booby-trapped, so anybody that moved them, bombs went off straight away. Tripwires, of course, we used tripwires too, but they used to have all sorts of gadgets around. Once we got into some of their dugouts, they were... You look, see something lying on thing and think, "Oh, that's a nice souvenir," but you never want to pick it up because it might be wired to something and something would go off. That sort of thing. We didn't have time.
But the attitudes were hardened.
Oh, very much so.
Yes.
Yes, very much so. Yes. And so far as actual engagements are concerned, the fighting was a very bloody affair. And regrettably, I must say that a lot of our troops were just hopelessly massacred. When we went to get these guns at Loos, there were jocks hanging on the wire, by the dozen, just mown down. It struck me that the approach to the attack was senseless in many ways. One could have achieved so much more if it had been... You can't just beat a trench down by massing a whole lot of infantry and rushing across. These fellows are just sitting waiting.
Yes, we must look much more deeply at the strategy and what
we
thought of it.
I think we do. I think, yes, of course, towards the end of the war we did, and of course since in the Second World War we must have done, from what I gather.
Keeping now to 1914, at the end of that year, do you think you could describe the characteristics of that period, the early period of the war? Had, for instance, stalemate set in then, or was the situation still fluid?
No, stalemate hadn't set in. Everybody had gone out there with high hopes. We were going to have the war over by Christmas. Ypres, of course, produced the very certain information that we were up against something pretty tough. Something we hadn't reckoned on. All the rumours we'd had about the German army and this and that weren't true. They were much more numerous and much more well equipped than we ever were. Of course, so far, it's not perhaps right to say that. As far as our regular army was concerned, I think it was probably the elite of the world. Beautifully trained, seasoned troops and very hardened soldiers, very well practiced in every way, but small. And you couldn't throw a mass of people away like that into an attack. You should have conserved those. You should have used those for probes and things, and if you're going to throw a mass in, confuse the German by throwing a mass of not quite so well-trained soldiers and bring in the other fellows where it mattered. No, I think we sacrificed a lot. And I think, again, going back to that early run-up to Christmas, you see, there was a terrific rush to volunteer. In London, we had all sorts of volunteer regiments starting. I know we had in the North Artists Rifles, the Quayside Battalion, all these fellows from well-trained jobs, educated fellows, officer material, going and joining in the ranks. And it wasn't until they'd been killing a lot of these people that they suddenly began to realize that they were wasting all the intelligent material as cannon fodder. So they then began to withdraw people for commissions, you see. But they'd wasted an awful lot. I mean, for instance, take now these pals of mine, the London Scottish, that came up to relieve us. I knew most of the... Well, I knew these two fellows, school friends, but I knew the quality of them. And highly intelligent battalion of infantry soldiers. Now, every one of those should have been out leading his own platoon instead of being all bunched together and shot at by machine guns. And they went, no doubt about their courage and in the case of a battle, but wasteful courage. And
when was this realized, do you think, that the waste of intelligent people, what sort of date would you put on it?
Well,
when
it
they
began,
started.
It began to be sort of talked about, but these things move very slowly. It began to be talked about in the early 15, but it wasn't until later in that year that they really began to seriously think about it, or do something about it. They thought about it for a long time before they really moved.
Could I ask you now about the role of the cavalry? It seems to me that fairly early on you were dismounted, weren't you, and given your other jobs, your communication jobs, you know, without a horse.
Yeah.
Could you explain about the role of the cavalry? Did it change in the First World War?
Not for a long, long time. You see, we were divisional cavalry, and in that sense we were tacked to infantry in a way. But there were cavalry divisions as well, regular soldiers. I think it's fair to say that the majority of the top generals were cavalry men, so they never abandoned the idea that they were going to make a breakthrough and the cavalry would attack. You see, but of course that never happened. They tried it on one or two occasions, and they made a bit of a thrust for a while, but I don't think that they ever effectively came off, simply because they were up against the kind of thing that, it wasn't a suitable cavalry occasion. It was like the Western Desert, for example. In fact, it was really, you might call a foot soldier's war with adequate gunner support. Machine guns were worth their weight in gold, very valuable weapon. And of course, once we got the Lewis gun and the and things like that, they were very good. And I think also that a more massive training in bombers too. People trained to use grenades and things in the right way and at the right time. And well, Jerry went into action with a full of these stick bombs hanging on his belt, pretty well every soldier. What I liked about the German organization was this, and I think we came to it later. In a German company, there was a bunch of sappers, there was a bunch of bombers, there was a bunch of machine gunners. You didn't have to apply to battalion to have a machine gun couple come and support an infantry platoon. They were there. They were part of it. They were a more homogeneous unit in the German thing, and I think a better one. It wasn't until towards the end of the war, when we were really fighting in the open, that we got away like that. Joined the war then. No, I think we had an awful lot to learn about tactics. We were commanded by a lot of Carolymen who never abandoned the idea that the cavalry were going to really break the German line up. And the only time that really ever happened was when the tanks did it.
Did the tanks, in effect, replace the cavalry in modern warfare?
Well, they of course, they weren't very good, but they did produce a terrific element of surprise and fright, and the Jerrys simply threw their weapons down and ran for it. My brother was a tank commander, and he said it was amazing. They broke the Hindenburg line. I don't think the tanks were fast enough or nippy enough to take the place of cavalry, because the speed of movement wasn't there. They were very slow and took years to get them up to the front line, you know, that sort of thing. Of course, it was the beginning of them. We had regiments of cavalry in the rear. They never did anything, except on one. Well, any history will probably tell you more about it than I can. They were hardly ever able to be used, but the generals never lost the feeling that they were going to use them. So we had the cavalry at the back. Now we were not cavalry in that sense. We weren't the kind of cavalry that would have taken part in charges with swords out and whatnot. As they were, or lancers, or whatever. We were more almost in the nature, you might say, of mounted infantry, because we were a screen. We were weaponed almost like a foot soldier, but we were more mobile, having a horse. And because we were able to skirt when infantry were on the move, able to skirt it, we were able to protect, be an effective screen. But our main role was information. If we came up against a superior force, we weren't supposed to try and fight them off. We were supposed to try and weigh up how many there were and withdraw with the information, put somebody else in to stop them, which we did, which I did, as a matter of fact, on that retreat from the Menin Road through the Wiltshire Regiment when they shot them up. It was, you see, in other words, it would have been a waste for us to try and fight, because what our people wanted was news. And we were wasting our potential by trying to fight. Leave it to the people who were there ready for it. So we gathered as much information as we could and then scuttled back like rabbits, you know. This is what's happening, and you fellas get on with it sort of thing, and they did.
Thank you very much. You've explained that very well. Could I ask you now about your experiences in 1915? I know you were at Neuve Chapelle.
Yeah.
Could you explain the situation there?
Well, I could explain, really, the situation which was at Neuve Chapelle. It was at Elbers Ridge. It was at Loos. It was all the same sort of experience. The attacks were planned, and we did a tremendous amount of hard work preparing the situation, digging saps, digging, tunneling, helping the carrier parties, getting, in the case of Loos. Before that battle, we spent days carrying up gas cylinders this big. We had poles, and these things were slung on poles, and an awful job getting them around the traverses, you see, once we got into the front line. But, you see, the Germans had used gas on us. Now, when they were going to... perhaps I should go on to Neuve Chapelle and what on first, but they were battles. I can't tell you anything about it except that they were pretty... We were trying to get Elbers Ridge, and of course we didn't. And again, coming back to the German machine gun potential, they just stopped us. We never really got anywhere. There was quite considerable attack. The division as such attacked. We were in the nature of communications backup all the time, getting stuff up to the front, and... As soon as there was any lull, when there were any relief coming on, we were in the trenches taking over. But in the case of later, of course, our regiment were definitely committed to ordinary infantry fighting. But that was after I left them.
What did you yourself witness of the Battle of Neuve-Chapelle? You know, could you describe the nature of that battle, the losses, the strategy?
Oh yes, we knew there was a show coming on, and we were employed in all kinds of jobs, getting stuff forward and ready, and dumps and things all prepared. When the infantry brigades were in the line, then we had South Staffs, Wiltshires, the Bedfordshire Regiment. I've got a whole list of them there. But they were in doing reliefs, and then they were in support trenches waiting to go on. And of course, we were mingled in with the sort of backup area, and the amount of wounded that was coming back was something pretty serious. We never really made any progress. We seemed to be in the same position when we went back to take over relief trench work again. We didn't seem to have got anywhere at all. And I think that it took a long time, after we'd gone from that part of the line, it took a long time for them to get possession of the Obers Ridge. And you know, the strange thing about it is, you talk about these things, but the ridge might be no higher than this room in relation to the rest of the country, you see, but to have that bit of extra height advantage was something that people fought for. And the idea was to get the Obers Ridge so that they could enfilade the approach south, approaching Hallock Haines and the pit area of Loos.
Was any gas used in that battle?
At Loos?
No, at Neuve-Chapelle. Keeping to that.
No, I don't think so. I can't remember, so long ago.
You mentioned the wounded, the vast numbers of wounded. Yeah. Did you see any evidence of the care they received when they came back to your lines? Could the facilities cope?
The care, of course, the care wasn't adequate enough, but very good. Full marks to the. Of course, we had stretcher bearers in the regiment. We had medical attached to it. There would be the initial job of salving the people. We were often after a show when we were on relief. We'd have to go out and get somebody in, you know, get them into the trench. Our first job was simply to try and stop whatever was happening, handle the person as little as possible, and turn them over to the Red Cross, or the RAMC rather. And now, as far as my experience of them is concerned, and I only knew of it by going visiting other people, I would say that it was very good.
Did you have any first aid training for this task of
me?
Picking people?
Yes. No, none.
The ordinary soldier, if you were on stretcher duty?
No, I didn't. And of course, I never was, I would never have. Well, I did carry a stretcher on one occasion when we brought this fellow out from Loos when we were getting these guns out. And another bloke, the sergeant major's young brother, he was hit too. But, I never had any medical training, never first aid training. I had a field dressing that was tucked in this pouch on the tail of my tunic in the inside, stretched in, which was to be used, but as far as that was concerned, it was just a large pad and a bandage and a little tube of iodine. Dump the iodine on the thing, push that on, tie it up, and get help as soon as you could, sort of thing. Nothing else. We did have fellows, of course, who were trained in first aid work in the regiment, who took command in situations like that. They gave the instructions. We did as we were told, but the regiment as a whole were trained as soldiers. They weren't trained as RAMC.
You mentioned earlier on how quickly you got used to the sight of wounded and dead bodies.
Oh, yes.
And the fact that someone at your right or left hand might be killed. But can you remember your sort of initiation into this? Were you shocked and horrified when it first happened?
Scared stiff. My first experience of anything like that was when we were actually still in a fluid condition around between Hooge and Gelleveld, which eventually became the Ypres salient. When we were really standing by, then you see we were standing by as cavalry. We were standing to our horses there in case the infantry made a bust in the line, then we would have been used to push through. Although that wasn't our special role, we'd have been able to get on with it. And we'd have been used because the cavalry regiments were, they weren't behind us at all, as far as I can remember. The 7th Division was pretty well on its own there for nearly a month. That's why they lost so many. But they were brilliant soldiers. They're amazing people, really. I mean, they were first-class discipline. To be just behind a bit of a front line where these fellows were and to hear the officer say, "Wait till I give the order," and they would be standing there and the shelling would be going on and the Germans would be rising to come out. And as they rose to come out, they were just sitting waiting and then, "Right, now," you see, and there was a little brrp, and everything vanished. And then, of course, gradually that front settled down into, instead of being strong points and little foxholes and whatnot, it settled down to be trenches. And then it was the old regime of manning trenches and reliefs and carrier parties.